The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
Now, to the author of a book that is really making waves. We all know Palo Alto as a big tech center, the home of Stanford University, a source of great innovation, wealth and power. But Malcolm Harris, author of Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism and the World, has put together a narrative of a dark place with a very different history to what we're used to hearing. A history that he says continues to influence the place today and its role as a center of big tech. Malcolm, we're used to laid back hippies and hoodies and jeans type histories of places like Palo Alto in California. But your history is very different. Tell me about the founding fathers and the Palo Alto system, as it's called.
Yeah, well, Palo Alto as a place emerges this period in the 1870s after the gold rush. And it emerges at the hands of this man, Leland Stanford, who's really representative of capital in the West at the time. He's the head of the railroad. He'd been governor of the state. He will in the future become senator of the state. Important guy. But his working men, the workers on the railroad, specifically the white workers, many of whom were Irish, would show up outside his house in San Francisco and yell at him and his family and threaten their lives. And so the way they responded to that was to move to the suburbs. But the suburbs don't exist yet, so he had to invent his own suburb, and that was Palo Alto.
And there are other darker sides in the past as well. Around, for example, you talk about eugenics.
From the very beginning, the town was built as a horse raising track to train trotting horses for the future. Horses at this time, the end of the 19th century, are the engines for the country. They're dragging boats through canals. They're dragging streetcars through the cities. They're dragging agricultural implements through the fields. They're dragging cannons through the battlefields. And Leland Stanford, this technologist, says, I'm going to reinvent the production of horses. That horses so far, horse raisers have waited till horses are too old in order to see who the fast ones are, in order to support those, their development and spread their genes. I'm a scientist. I'm a capitalist. I can do it differently. And so what he does is he invests in creating this giant complex that starts racing horses from birth, basically, from yearling, as fast as they can. And as a result, he's breaking a lot of these horses, shattering their legs, break a ligament, and these kind of things are fatal for a horse. But because he's doing it at such a large scale, he can afford to do it. And they call this system, he and his head trainer, Charles Marvin, they call this the Palo Alto system for raising horses. And they do successfully raise the fastest, youngest horses in the country. And very quickly, it transitions from that into Stanford University, which from the beginning has this eugenic agenda. And the first president of the school, this guy, David Starr Jordan, is an internationally prominent eugenicist and sets the school and the town on that path.
With the history of Stanford, there was an interesting story that you recount in the book about Jane Stanford. And who was she and what happened to her?
Jane Stanford is the wife of Leland Stanford, who we were just discussing, and the mother of Leland Stanford Jr., who's the couple's only son. And after his untimely death as a young teenager, the couple found Leland Stanford Jr. University. And after Leland Stanford Sr.'s death, it's Jane who really stewards the university at the beginning, makes sure that it has the resources to flourish. She gets rid of the stock farm, the horse stock farm, and focuses on this school. She dies unexpectedly. And for a long time, the story was that she was sort of a crazy lady who just dies. There's been new accounting, sort of new revisions of the story, and it seems very clear at this point, and I write in the book, that she was poisoned not once, but actually twice before she dies. She ultimately dies in Hawaii. And David Starr Jordan, the president of the school, is able to take over the university. Now, it's very convenient timeline for him because the two of them were in a conflict and she was getting ready to fire him. And so now, looking back, it seems clear that he had an important role in the cover-up, at least, if not in the murder itself.
So lots of dark forces at work. You put it together and you've got eugenics, you've got international labor who are being badly treated and shouting outside the house of Leyland Stanford. You've got this sort of dark past. It's almost like, you know, the Calvin Candy Leonardo DiCaprio character in Django Unchained. It's pretty dark origins.
And Leland Stanford, as governor, is personally signing, you know, the funding requisitions to support the militias that are going out and clearing native people from the land, murdering native people and stealing their land. And this happens during the 1860s, during the American Civil War, and it's so often written out of our history and sort of blamed on Spanish colonialists or blamed on Mexican dictators or blame someone else other than these California founding fathers, who are the ones who are really responsible.
This is a completely different image in the history to one of a modern Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. It's seen as the light. It's seen as a place of innovation. It's seen as a place of excellence. It's seen as a place of wealth creation and a place where people with amazing ideas who have founded extraordinary technology companies have changed the world.
And yet that's the same history that we're talking about. You know, the length from one to the other is so short. And that's one of the things I really get at this book, is that we're talking about under 200 years. And even in American history, that's short. Obviously, in European history, that's just the blink of an eye. But even in American history, it's a short period of time. And it is modernity. And so from the beginning, they are engineers. They're interested in technological development. They're raising these horses to be the best engines in the world at the time. And so they're not two different periods. It's the same time.
So for you, there's a continuity about it. But in the book, you're so critical and quite visceral about the negative impact that this form of capitalism, this form of wealth generation, and the impact that this technology is having in the world. You're so critical of it that it's almost as if you don't acknowledge that there are any upsides at all, basically, to the impact that this technology is having on our lives.
Well, the impact that the technology is having, I think, has to be distinguished from the impact that the social systems are having. So it's not that computers do one thing or another, or the internet does one thing or another. It's that there's a historical project here, and that's the story I'm trying to tell. It's that Palo Alto is for something historically, and we have to try and understand what that is. And it's not just the general unfolding of technological progress throughout the world, as some people would have us believe. So what we really need to do is critically look at the stories that Silicon Valley is offering about itself, and especially about its lead entrepreneurs, and these men who have stories about how they have advanced human society through their technical knowledge. When, if you look at what they've actually been able to accomplish and how, it's so often, and again, for over 100 years, so often has to do with labor relations rather than actual technological development.
So what you're saying is that they're ultimately, from a global perspective, in a sort of cost race to the bottom to enrich themselves.
And have been for a very long time. And so the we talk about the semiconductor industry now and the chip industry now, and talk about offshoring and taking jobs and moving them to the Pacific, perhaps. This is a process that starts in the 80s or 90s. This is a process that starts in 1961, almost as soon as this technology is developed. And so those labor histories, those geopolitical labor histories, are core to the technology itself. They are essential to the technology itself.
Some of the critics of the book have said that because of your own left-wing views, that this is a bit like a Marxist polemic, and the long shadow of Karl Marx runs through the book, in the sense they're accusing you of seeing things through just a single lens of a left-wing perspective and seeing everything that fell into place in the history of Palo Alto within that narrative. What would you say to that?
Well, it's a left-wing perspective. I'm a left-wing guy. I'm a Marxist. And that's the kind of analysis I'm going to offer of this history. There are plenty of non-Marxist histories of Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. If readers want to read one of those, they're more than available. In fact, that's almost the entirety of the subject. So I'm offering a distinct perspective, and I think people have been pretty interested in it, it turns out.
Karl Marx, in his writings, analyzed so brilliantly what was going on in 19th century industrialization in Europe, and few could fault many aspects of his analysis, but the solutions that he proposed haven't worked. What's your solution?
Well, there's a really interesting letter that I actually don't talk about in the book, but it's one of the few places where Karl Marx talks about California. And he has it's this great letter to Engels, and he says, you know, I've been looking at California and China and the rest of the world, and it looks like as long as capital still has all this place to expand, we can try to do these revolutions in Europe, you know, in the 19th century, but they're probably not going to work if capital has all this room to keep expanding into the 20th century. The capital is going to last much longer than we think it can because it has this globalizing move to do. And I think that analysis was correct, you know, that the European revolutions did fail and that capital has expanded into a global system and that has given it room to run much longer than Marx and his contemporaries imagined. However, we look now, and that's where I arrive at the conclusion of the book, with not much more room left to run. And again, it's only been fewer than 200 years of global capitalism and they've already run out of room to run.
You say that tech's only role has been to devise tools for mass exploitation and to support military aggression as well.
I think, yeah, that's been the central role of Silicon Valley in the world. If you look at the first generation of silicon chips, for example, they go entirely into the nuclear missiles of the Minuteman I nuclear missile program. And that's a gun pointed at the world's head saying, you know, if anything happens to us, everyone gets it. And that's been the iconic and really representative action of Palo Alto and Silicon Valley throughout the world.
But the technology, Malcolm, has done an awful lot more than that. You know, people around the world can work in all kinds of more flexible ways. They can stay in contact with other people in all kinds of new ways that can enrich their lives. They can, you know, there are so many upsides to the technology. Whereas you seem to be focused only on the darker past and how that fits into a darker present.
I think it's interesting that when you went to go look for the benefits of this Silicon Valley technology, the first thing that you went for is people everywhere can work more flexibly. Who has that flexibility served? What has happened to the world as a result of those changes to the labor relation? Has it been positive for people, right? Like, yeah, now we don't have cabs, you've got Uber instead. Is that better or worse? Well, it might be better for someone who pulls out their phone and gets to click and doesn't have to talk to somebody and doesn't have to hail a cab. But is it better for the cab driver? No, we know it's worse.
Yeah, people can actually live in places and work there and make a living and survive there in ways that they couldn't have done without the technology. They can stay in communication with each other. It's also given people more of maybe a personal voice as well.
Which has then allowed their employers to cut wages. So this is an important part of the Marxist analysis, is understanding that things can get worse by improving, right? Is that your wage can go up, and because your employer's profit goes up by more, your exploitation is increasing even as your wage increases, right? And so that's the mechanism that's driving history at this point. And so we really need to understand how that works and how things can get worse through seeming to improve.
So what kind of reaction have you had to the book so far in Palo Alto?
I've been there three times at this point. I launched the book there and I've done a couple events at Stanford University. So
have you heard from any tech billionaires?
Only on Twitter, but it's a long book and they've got busy lives, I hear. So I'd be surprised if any of them has read every paragraph.
You're questioning their attention span there as well, Malcolm.
Far be it from me to question the attention span of a tech billionaire.
Well, Malcolm Harris, it's a fascinating book, author of Palo Alto, A History of California, Capitalism and the World. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.